This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. All of the lights.
Episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation history, the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke, and we're here to bring you another exciting edition of the Long Book Hunters.
Not that you have to worry about being overly factually accurate when claiming to be the longest running week episodic anything, giving the precedent that's been set by certain other companies. But are you sure that's an accurate claim? Wouldn't it be more accurate to say we're the longest-running weekly episodic program in Place to Be Nation pop history?
That's true. We are now in our own galaxy of the Place to Be Nation universe. Or is it our own universe in the Place to Be Nation multiverse?
Ooh, I think with the comics thing, I think I like the multiverse thing better. But that's just me.
Let's take it from a multiversal aspect. And as such, we're here proud to be bringing you our thoughts in our own little corner of the universe on the world of comics. And in this case, we're back with the Long Book Hunters, which is our monthly look at a trade paperback collection or graphic novel. These are books that you can find in any bookstore for the most part, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon, or your local comic book shop. And this month, we're looking at a book that is especially dear to the two of our hearts, a book called Green Lantern Rebirth. This is a book from 2004?
Not to be confused with Green Lantern's Rebirth, which we just talked about last week.
Indeed. You see, in the midst of all of this talk recently about DC Rebirth, and with good cause, we thought, what better time to go back and revisit the original Rebirth? This was early into Geoff Johns's comic book career, relatively speaking, around 2004, and it marked the return not only of Hal Jordan as the predominant Green Lantern of Earth, but also the return of the Green Lantern Corps and a lot of other things we'll be getting into later in the podcast. We're also really excited because for the first time in Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast history, we're going to have a guest today. A friend of mine named Jennifer Smith has recently read Green Lantern Rebirth for the very first time, and she's going to have a much different perspective, I would expect, than Nick or I, who read it, you know, almost a decade ago at this point. And she is a pretty new reader of regular DC comics, so it's going to be an interesting thing to hear her perspective compared to people like us who have been in the loop for many, many years and are Green Lantern aficionados of sorts. And Nick, you're going to have a chance to add some particular historic context to this podcast because you have gone through and read a lot of the silver and bronze and even modern age Green Lantern books, correct?
I have read every non-Kyle Rayner issue of Green Lantern. So pretty much post Emerald Twilight, I kind of stopped, you know, ceased my reading project of a few years ago. And so I have this gap in my knowledge of pretty much from the time Emerald Twilight ends until Rebirth begins. So I've got a pretty solid, what's that, about a 10 to 12 year gap, I guess, in my knowledge base. Now I have read a few Kyle issues here and there, but most of those are ones that involve, like, you know, time travel subplots that also have Hal Jordan in them. So
so there's no real room out there for any of you Green Lantern experts to push your glasses up and start to wag your fingers at us because we are coming at it.
I'm sure I'll misspeak at some point. So
well, you know, and obviously we're coming at it from more of a view on the totality of Green Lantern than right. some people that we'll address later that might be coming at it from specifically the Kyle Rayner years.
Yeah,
might
say, view- and I'm sure there are some humanoids out there who prefer Kyle Rayner to Hal Jordan for whatever reason that might, you know, take some umbrage with some things we say. Those people
it's like,
don't matter.
No, it's like preferring the Nature Boy Buddy Landell to the Nature Boy Ric Flair. I mean, come on. Yeah. There's no comparison, really. But
it's like comparing David Flair to Ric Flair is what it's like comparing.
Right, yes, rosy cheeks and all. And that blatant bit of trolling is brought to you by, once again, the hard-traveling fanboys. You can hit us up on Twitter, you know the usual. We'll hit you at the end of it with our Twitter handles. Maybe you'll have forgotten your anger at us by then, Kyle fans. But anyhow, before we get to all that, we're going to start off with our normal run-of-the-mill segment we like to call What You're Reading, What You're Watching. And I guess to kick it off, speaking of Rebirth.
Oh, thank God you're not singing a song this week.
No, not this week. Not this week. I have thought about possibly getting you to sing a song in which you'll have to repeat the phrase Telltale Games over and over and over again. So
Telltale Games.
There we go. So, in any event, I think that we've both been reading a lot of DC Rebirth in the last week, whether it be for this podcast or whether it be just in our normal weekly reading of this new event going on. So
this was probably actually my heaviest reading week in a long time because in addition to DC Rebirth stuff, I also made a concerted effort not to get too far behind on my other stuff. So I'm up to date again. So I'm going to let you. I guess we'll start with DC Rebirth stuff, then I'll come in with some brief thoughts on the numerous other things I read this week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first off, we had the second wave, I guess you would say, of DC Rebirth titles this past week. You had Aquaman Rebirth, Flash Rebirth, Wonder Woman Rebirth, and the return to their original numberings of Detective Comics and Action Comics. Did I miss any in there?
No, I think that's the whole run. And then we talked about this last week, you know, your thoughts on it, but I also went back this week and read Superman Rebirth from the previous week's release schedule.
Yeah, I forgot about that you hadn't read that yet. So that's gonna set us up nicely for that as well. So why don't you start us off talking about that? Since we talked about that book last week, what were your thoughts on Superman Rebirth?
Just to keep it kind of brief, because you know we did touch on it pretty heavily last week. We're going to talk about Action Comics here in a minute, and I got to be honest, I thought Action Comics was a much better introduction and jumping on point for new readers, introducing this new status quo of you know pre Flashpoint Superman with Lois and John and the challenges he's going to face in Metropolis than Superman Rebirth was. I understand the need, I guess, for kind of a eulogy to the New 52 Superman, but it doesn't really play as a Rebirth title to me very well. So while I think the book was well drawn and I think it was well written, I guess I just didn't understand the need for it, so to speak. So ultimately, I would say it's a good book, but I would also say it feels very out of place in this Rebirth slate, in my opinion.
You know, I agree with that. I had the same thoughts when I read Action Comics that you did because I liked Superman Rebirth for what it was. Like, I appreciated what they were trying to do in a way that addressed the concerns that the pre-Flashpoint fans had about the way their favorite characters were treated. Because remember, we didn't get a send-off for Wally West. We didn't get a send-off for post-crisis Superman. We didn't get a send-off for so many of these characters who were started over from ground zero, basically, the original Teen Titans, things like that. So I think that in this case, DC was wise to give a proper farewell to the New 52 Superman that almost like whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow back in the 80s gave a farewell to pre-crisis Superman. Now, this wasn't nearly as good a story as that was, but I understand why they did it, but Action was a way better hook for new readers, in my opinion. It was a way better jumping on point as well because it immediately sets you up with the status quo going forward of Metropolis, which is pretty interesting. I guess since we're talking Superman, we might as well transition over to that. Action, I thought, was a really strong book this week. It was
I would agree, yeah.
Dan Juergens writing and Patrick Zercher on art, who I think both of us have been high on for a while.
And yeah, he was on Green Arrow with Ben Percy for a little while, and I was, as you know, very high on that that run of Green Arrow. So, big fan of his work that I've seen thus far. That's really probably my only exposure to him, even though I know he's been around a while. But that's more through my own, you know, time constraints and being able to seek out things to read like I should.
Right, right. And this basically sets up what I think is the most interesting new status quo for Superman in a long time, because you've got, and I'm not going to spoil the details of the book, but you've got, as people are calling him, Dad Superman, a mature, married father Superman who is trying to raise a family and stay hidden, but he's drawn out of hiding in a pretty funny page when his kid sees Lex Luthor on the television screen, and Lex is wearing the S shield that you might have seen at the end of Justice League 50. Lex is now created or been given a suit, basically, that gives him powers enough to be Superman. And he wears the S shield, and he claims to be Metropolis's new hero who's trying to live up to the legacy of the New 52 Superman. So that in and of itself is interesting. Pre-Flashpoint Superman, Dad Superman, if you will, now comes out and makes himself public to say, no, I'm Superman. And then at the same time, you're seeing a reintroduction via the mysterious Mr. Oz character, who we've talked about before, may very well be Ozymandias from The Watchmen. And he's kind of maneuvering things in the background, and we see the return of what appears to be the original incarnation of Doomsday, for lack of a better.
A pre-Flashpoint Doomsday.
So it's a pretty interesting conundrum. My favorite part of the issue was the back and forth between Clark and Lex, because Superman only knows Lex from his universe. So to him, Lex Luthor's evil. It doesn't matter what he says. Lex is New 52, for lack of a better term, Lex. And I thought this was one of the most interesting dynamics in the book, because I think there is some question as to, is it possible that Lex is actually being genuine? I don't think he is, but is it possible that he is? And he wants the glory for it, of course, but is it possible that he actually does want to be a hero now after what happened in Justice League?
I suppose the story has been written in a way to make you believe that, but me being, you know, a little bit more jaded, I'm always going to assume that Lex Luthor has something up his sleeve.
I agree. I that's the way I lean as well, but it, to the credit of Juergens and Zercher, the way he drew it, it's left ambiguous. It's left to the point where, and I feel like maybe one of the ideas of the story is going to be maybe the pre-Flashpoint Superman is going to be looked down upon by the public. Do you remember the episode of JLU that had Captain Marvel on it, and Lex pretty much manipulated the situation to make it look like Superman was bullying and beating down Captain Marvel, and Lex was actually going straight, basically, and Superman went through and destroyed this low-income housing development that Lex had built because he thought Lex had a bomb in there, and it wasn't a bomb at all. It was like a birthday surprise or something.
I don't remember that at all, honestly, but I'll take your word for it that it existed.
Yes. Anyway, that's what this reminded me of, is I feel like it's going to be one of those deals where the public might at first not believe that this Superman is who he claims to be because he's too good to be true or whatever, and that Lex is –
Well, plus the entire world saw Superman die, so I think there's going to be
– Precisely.
That whole thing going on.
But anyway, I think we both agree it was a really good really good jumping on point. Are you going to actually jump on to Action Comics, or what's your I know you've never pulled it in the past.
I'm going to try it out for a couple issues before I make a long-term commitment and see how it goes. Want to follow it at least two or three issues before I make a long-term pull list decision. But I'm intrigued. I'll put it that way. I'm certainly intrigued right now.
Yeah, and that one was actually my favorite book of the week. But let's get to your favorite book of the week. And you talked about this a little at length on Seller's Point, the most recent podcast up on PTB and Pop from the comics department. But tell us a little bit about Aquaman Rebirth, because we both loved this issue. This was Dan Abnett and a couple of artists, Oscar Jimenez and Scott Eaton, I believe, on art. Right. Tell us a little bit about this one. What was it that won the week for you in terms of this book?
Just the general approach. As I've discussed before, Dan Abnett's Aquaman is the closest thing to Geoff Johns' Aquaman we've had since then. And I think the main thing that John's Aquaman had that really won me over was a willingness to confront the fact that it's Aquaman. Like, you're going to have people who are going to snicker, and you're going to have people who are going to laugh and make fun and poke, you know, have their little jokes. And so I like the fact that, you know, this Aquaman book confronts that up front. It makes fun of itself. It's not afraid to not take itself seriously at times. And so add that in with the continued emergence of Mira as one of the most fascinating characters in all the DC universe, and the reemergence of Black Manta in a big bad way, and his new motivation going forward, and the way he's finally discovered to get at Aquaman the way he's always dreamed of. Everything just kind of came together for me, and I thought this was far and away, or I won't say far and away, but it's my favorite book of Rebirth thus far, honestly. Excepting, obviously, DC Universe Rebirth Zero, the 80-page special.
Right. Now, one of the things that I loved about this, and you touched upon it, is Black Manta has kind of been sitting on the shelf for a couple years now, at least in terms of the Aquaman side. I think he's been in Suicide Squad, if I'm not mistaken. But as far as the Aquaman side goes, he's kind of been on the shelf for a while. Right. So I mean, pretty
his
cool.
His last major involvement was in Forever Evil. He was in that.
Yeah. So it's been pretty cool to see him get a chance to go back out in the spotlight. Looks like that's where we're heading with him as the big bad in this new run. And I love that because I love what Geoff Johns did with Ocean Master. But to me, Black Manta is the Aquaman villain. Right. So he's the Sinestro of the Aquaman universe, basically. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where they go with it. I know you and Todd Weber have been very high on Abnett's Aquaman in general. So I bought this one. I didn't regret it. I'm hooked. I'm going to add it on the list and look forward to see where it goes from there. That leaves us with what's left? Oh, an outstanding book that we haven't mentioned yet, Detect Comics.
Yep.
James Tynion IV started his run on Detective Comics in a spectacular fashion, I would say. It's basically a team book.
Which is interesting because you were very hesitant about this
book. I was very hesitant. And I'll tell you why. Let me tell you why, to paraphrase good old JR. I was hesitant about this book because I've never cared – and this is going to be controversial material for those listening. I have never cared, for the most part, about Tim Drake. I just haven't. He never stuck with me in a – I didn't hate him. He just never really had any connection with me. I never cared about Stephanie Brown, the spoiler, if you will. I never cared about Cassandra Cain. And this book stars the three of them.
Basically, Greg never cared about most of the 1990s Batman mythos.
I wouldn't agree with that. I would say most of the 1990s Batman supporting characters. I would say that. I didn't really – of course, I didn't like Azrael very much once they decided not to make him a villain. And other than that, I mean, Harold was fine. He was a hunchback and he fixed things. You know, who doesn't like that?
So you liked the hunchback mute more than you liked Tim Drake, Stephanie Brown, and Cassandra Cain.
I know. It's controversial. I can't help it. He was a hunchback,
for
God's sake.
I'm just trying
to
clarify. I'm not, you know.
Quite
frankly, a man's entitled to his own damn opinion.
The 90s was a decade in which there were a lot of characters introduced in comics who we were told were better than the previous versions of those characters. For instance, Tim Drake was way smarter than Dick Grayson, and he was the next Batman. Even though Dick Grayson had already been there, I kind of resented the fact that the writers made it so clear that he's the closest thing to Bruce. They flat out would say in the comics, he's the closest thing to me, guys. And then Alfred would say, he reminds me so much of you, sir. Even though he really didn't in the way he was written to me. He was kind of written the same as Dick was written to an extent. But that being neither here nor there, I didn't read his solo book, and I'm sure that's where a lot of people grew so attached to him. But I, you know, to the same degree, Kyle Rayner, who we'll address later, there were a lot of characters that came out at that time that were like, you know, hey, look at how much cooler this character is than the old guy that had the role. And it wasn't a situation of both of these characters are great. It was, let's tell you why this one's more important than that one. Anyway, but there was also a distinct effort in the early to mid-90s to separate Dick Grayson from the Batman mythos for some reason. So Anyhow, that's getting way off topic. Anyhow, but that's three of the main characters in Detective Comics. I also have not traditionally been high on James Tynion as a writer. He's been okay, but most of the stuff I've read from him has just been kind of average comics. This was not average. This was really, really good. This was a top three or four book for me in the entire Rebirth Initiative so far. What'd you think of it, Nick?
I liked it a lot as well. I don't know that I would necessarily go top three or four, maybe like top four or five. I think I'd have to think about the way those books stack up to me.
But, yeah, I mean, it may be top five, but it's in that elite
the
status.
The upper half, we can yeah, comfortably say. I liked it a lot, actually, but I was looking forward to it a lot more than you were. It's a characterization of Bruce and a characterization of Batwoman, actually, that I find really, really intriguing. And not to mention the weird thing about the premise, about the solicits we had heard going forward, was that Clayface was going to be a member of a heroic team here. And I wasn't really sure how that would play, but the Clayface scene in this book where he's introduced to the team is probably, and this isn't covering a lot of ground, because let's take our bat-colored glasses off for a minute and confront the fact there haven't really been that many great Clayface stories in the comics.
No.
This book probably had my favorite Clayface I've ever seen in print. Liked it a lot. Heartbreaking.
The best Clayface has always been on the animated series.
Right. And this, and that's the best compliment I can give this book, is it's the book that's felt the most like the animated series in a long, long time to me. It just kind of had that tone about it. And so I liked it a lot, obviously.
Yeah, good jumping on point. And one of the things that it does is it does that Johnsian thing where it distills these characters into easily digestible ideas and concepts. In other words, you have five, am I correct, five members of this team, basically, that they're trying to introduce to you: Batwoman, Spoiler, Cassie Kane, Tim Drake, and Clayface.
Plus Batman, obviously.
And they avoid introducing Batman, really, but they don't really need to. It's Batman. But these other characters, they're each given a page and they're each given descriptors that boil them down into the essence of their characters. And that's something that all jumping on points should do in comics. It's something that Geoff Johns does better than anybody. And James Tynion really tapped into that with this book. So, yeah, I'm interested. I'm going to jump on this as well, which is going to kill my wallet. But I'm going to do it because I've got to see where they're going. It's a great team book. And we haven't had a Bat Family team book in what feels like forever.
Well, to be fair, Batman Eternal, Batman and Robin Eternal over the last couple of years have both kind of served as that.
True. I guess it's hard for me because I couldn't – there was no way I could follow a weekly comic. So I didn't really read either of those extensively. But in terms of a monthly, or if this is going to be bi-monthly, I don't know. But
it is bi-monthly, yes.
But yeah, so it's been a long time. It's been probably since the Gotham Knights series back in the late 2000s. Or Batman Inc., I guess, if you would count that.
Oh, God, let's move on.
Let's move on to Wonder Woman Rebirth. Greg Rucka's long-awaited return to the character of Diana of Themyscira, Wonder Woman. A book that ties pretty heavily into DCU Rebirth in a way that a lot of the other issues haven't. And
also
really
Justice
good
League 50 as well.
And Justice League 50. Liam Sharp on art. And there was another artist that I don't have handy with me. Actually, I do. And that would be someone with the last name Clark. So, Clark, if you're out there, good job. I don't know the first name. But, yeah. So, Rucka's return to Wonder Woman. Pretty good success, I would say. I mean, I've seen people complaining that it was very slow. And there's literally not much action in it at all. I mean, only in the first couple pages. But I loved how it tied into the DCU Rebirth issue, because this is a direct address of the conflicting origins of Wonder Woman, that she has these two distinct, or really more than that, but these two distinct modern origins of made from clay, daughter of Zeus. And these two paths do not seem to mash up. So it seems like this new series of Wonder Woman is going to pursue her trying to get to the truth of who she is, what her history is, and the truth about her long-lost brother. So the issue worked for me. Did it work for you?
I loved it. Behind Aquaman, I think it's the second best book of Rebirth thus far. I can also see why it would be a divisive book. To me, it's the slowest, and it almost feels the most literary in a way. Like it seems to rest more on the strength of its writing than any of the other books that are here. It doesn't. The art's good, don't get me wrong, but it's not wowing you with images, with evocative splash pages and that kind of things. Because, I mean, 90% of the book is Wonder Woman's interior monologue in her apartment. So it doesn't have a ton of stuff to do that's overly, you know, visually appealing. So, but it worked for me. I found it a great introduction for new readers into just who Wonder Woman is, you know, inside, you know, who she is inside her own head rather than who she is as an ideal. And I'm very intrigued by the possibility of confronting those conflicting origins going forward, especially, and it makes a lot of sense because, as we've discussed before, Rucka's approach to the bi-monthly shipping schedule is going to be a little bit different in that he's actually going to tell two separate stories that will alternate. He's going to tell a flashback story that's going to be called Wonder Woman Year One, and he's going to tell a present-day story as well. So very interesting to see where he goes going forward.
One thing we didn't get in this issue that we're going to get in the regular series is Nicola Scott on art.
Right.
So I'm really looking forward to that. I believe that she is doing the past issues and Liam Sharp is doing the present tense issues. So it should be really cool. Greg Rucka is just money as a writer, especially in the DCU. He knows Wonder Woman better than just about anybody outside of maybe George Perez. So it's going to be fun to see where this all goes. And again, for the first time in my life, I'm sure for the first time in your life, I am actively interested in adding Wonder Woman to my monthly subscription list. So
yeah, it's on my subscription list. It's got a place there. It had a place there as soon as Rucka was announced. I was interested in the Azzarello run, but you know, all props to Azzarello, but he ain't no Greg Rucka in my book. So looking forward.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I'd love to read the Azzarello run and trade, but yeah, it's Greg Rucka, man. We've been needing him around for a while. And that leaves us with one last Rebirth from this batch, and that was the Flash Rebirth, which I thought was probably the weakest of this week's Rebirth. I think it was better than Batman Rebirth, but that was from last week. It's still not bad, though. I mean, that's the thing. We haven't read a bad book in this bunch, folks. Right. It was still a good book. It's just, for me, the art was kind of...
It was strange at times.
Weird. Yeah. There was like a weird left-handed handshake at one point, and just some weird perspective stuff going on. But as a story, it was fine. I mean, it was good. It really redefined the Barry Allen and Bruce Wayne relationship in a way that I thought was really cool that I haven't seen before. Have you seen that kind of take on their relationship?
No, because while you know, Barry is a crime scene investigator and is something of a scientist, he's never been presented, from what I've been able to tell anyway, as being a detective or a scientist on Bruce's level. You know, and this felt like Bruce treating Barry as an equal in that regard, and so that was really interesting. You're right, the Batman and Flash stuff that was in here was really, really interesting to me. The problem was it wasn't enough of the book, in my opinion. I loved everything in this book that was dealing directly with either Wally West that came straight out of CU Rebirth, or dealing with Batman and the mystery of the comedian pin and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the first pretty much like 60% of the book, I just kind of was waiting for it to get going. And that's not to say it was bad. It just was somewhat uninteresting to me. But that last 40% made up for that in a big, big, huge way.
I would agree with that criticism. I thought the first few pages were pretty boring. I wasn't really interested in the murder mystery at the beginning. But overall, a solid issue. It got better as it went. Again, the interactions between the established characters were what was interesting. And the interactions with the random cop characters, not so much. And I think for people that watch the TV show, it almost felt like treading over ground that we've seen before.
Very familiar ground, yeah.
Yeah, but that's fine. It's a jumping on point for new people, and I think it was a cool little hook. And I'm interested because I think that not enough writers have played up Barry's detective elements when he's around the Justice League, because it feels like when he's around the Justice League, he's kind of almost in a support role or in a comedic relief role, and not enough writers have focused on the fact that he is a professional investigator.
It's weird because outside of Jeff Johns, I feel like people who write the League in recent years still write Barry as if he's Wally in a way.
Yeah.
Like using him for that comedic relief role, which was never really Barry's deal in the past.
Well, real quick, give us a rundown of what else you've been reading that week. That's pretty much all I've been on. So what have you, give us a little bullet point of what you've been reading.
I got a little stack, and I'll go through them pretty quick. Mostly Marvel stuff, but a couple DC things I was running behind on. Spider-Man number 4, that's the Miles Morales book. Picked up the new issue of that. Kind of moves forward their plot, which is dealing with Hammerhead and Black Cat and Electro kind of aligning together to take on Miles Morales for reasons as yet unrevealed. Interesting way to move it forward. Also got a pretty cool revelation with Miles and his best friend Ganke that should be interesting in terms of how those characters interact going forward. Invincible Iron Man number 10, which was encapsulates a lot of my issues with the way that the publishing schedule for Civil War II has been laid out, because this book is marketed as The Road to Civil War II, and it came out the same week as Civil War II number 1, which would technically mean The Road to Civil War II has already gotten here, especially considering at Free Comic Book Day we saw the opening salvo in Civil War II. So that's neither here nor there. Sinestro 23, the last issue of Sinestro in the New 52. Liked the book. You know, I've talked up Sinestro a lot on here. Gotta say, though, this one felt really abrupt, like it was rushing a lot of stuff, and just kind of, at the end, it just kind of ended without a lot of resolution or a lot of clear motivation for Sinestro to be moving back into an antagonistic role with the Green Lantern Corps. So, don't really know what that is going forward. Guess what? Let's pick up Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps to get the rest of that story. Obi-Wan and Anakin number 5, the final issue of that one of the Star Wars miniseries they've been doing. This book has been good, but ultimately a little bit of a disappointment, because I've always thought that period of Anakin's life before episode 2, the period in between episode 1 and 2, was some really interesting stuff, or interesting material to be mined, I should say. And, you know, this book isn't bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it's ultimately forgettable, I would say. The art's
basically, you mean the formative years of his life.
Yes, and they don't really do much with it here, except for there's some flashback sequences that deal with him, the beginnings of his relationship with the Emperor, and as you would expect, those are excellent. But the modern day, current day story doesn't really do much for me. Green Lantern Corps, Edge of Oblivion 6, a decent book that ends in the most like cookie cutter way you would imagine, where the Corps just magically hops through a rift back into our dimension with no real explanation of how it got there, and it's just a kind of a convenient Deus Ex Machina, in my opinion.
Putting a thankful nail in the coffin of the DC YOU Green Lantern era.
Yes, thank the Lord. The Mighty Thor number 7, once again drawn by this dude named Rafa Garris that I blasted last time, and it's just as bad again this time. Thank God that two-part flashback story is over, and we can move on to better things. And then I'll get into some of the more interesting ones I'll have a little bit more in-depth thoughts on, and I'll save the most interesting for last. And by interesting, I don't mean good. Old Man Logan number 7, fantastic issue. This continues to be probably the best book that Marvel is doing right now outside of, I'll say this, the best non-Star Wars title that Marvel is doing right now. Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino continue to be just a dynamic duo when it comes to comics, and I highly, highly recommend this book to anyone who's out there who is even moderately interested in Wolverine. Star Wars number 19, the final issue of a story that involved it's weird. They kind of had a crossover coming out of a crossover in that they did a crossover a while back called Vader Down, which was a crossover between the main Star Wars title and the Darth Vader title. And coming out of that, one of Darth Vader's supporting characters was actually taken captive by the Rebel Alliance. And so this book kind of ends up that story of that character being held captive by the Rebels, if that makes any sense. Good book, as always, and then it led into an even better book. For my money, the best Marvel book in comics, and a top contender for the best book in comics, period, is Star Wars Darth Vader series right now. And we just got issue 21, and it looks like we are gearing up for a big, huge climax. This book prepares to end at issue 25, so can't say enough good things about that. Now, something I don't have much good to say about. Civil War II, number 1.
I'm interested in hearing your thoughts.
There's still not a believable reason for this to call for the entire Marvel universe to be in a civil war, in my opinion. The book is well drawn. The dialogue is mostly well written, but it's just wholly uninteresting. And in another frustrating publishing move, the inciting event of Civil War II, from what I understand, is going to be spoilers, the death of James Rhodes, the death of War Machine. That event, his death, was shown in the pages of the Free Comic Book Day issue.
The Free Comic Book Day issue, yeah. I think that enough time has passed between that and now that, you know, we should be safe on that.
Right.
Just in case, we'll put up a helpful wing on the page.
Right. But the problem is, it's shown in the Free Comic Book Day issue. His death is never shown in Civil War II, number one. They skip the scene entirely. So unless you got the Free Comic Book Day issue, you missed the actual death scene. They go from before the climactic showdown with Thanos that we saw in that issue to the aftermath of it, and do not really make much reference to what happened.
Is there any better context given to why it happened?
It happened because Captain Marvel was using the Inhuman Ulysses to look into the future and see that Thanos had designs on obtaining a cosmic cube, and he was going to use it in the future to wreak havoc upon Earth. And so Captain Marvel baited Thanos into coming to Earth by making him believe a cosmic cube was implication that it wasn't, and it led to a big confrontation between Thanos and her team, the Ultimates, but she also called in James Rhodes for help. And so the crux of this, the conflict, I can understand, is Tony Stark had warned her against taking too much preemptive action, which is mind-boggling that they're putting Tony Stark in that moral position. But, you know, that's another thing for another day. And he is only angered further by the death of his best friend. So that appears to be the crux of the issue.
There may not be a good reason for them to be into a civil war, but it is going to lead to Free State of Jones number one. So keep that in mind.
What in the world are you talking about?
Why, have you not seen the advertisements for the new Matthew McConaughey feature, Free State of Jones?
What does that have to do with anything?
Well, you see, that movie takes place during the American Civil War. One man fought to create his own independent country within an independent country.
Right.
And it was the Free State of Jones. So now, clearly, this is going to be about the Free State of Rhodes.
Well, Rhodes is dead.
Well, who says he can't have his own country then?
That's a great point.
See? With brain trust like this, it's no secret why we are the longest-running weekly episodic radio podcast.
In Place to Be Nation
pop history about comic books.
So with all that said, let's move on to give our brief thoughts on what we were watching this week. What did you watch this week, Greg?
The only comic book related things that I watched was I rewatched Deadpool, which I won't say much about, but I did love. I actually liked it just as much the second time through.
I haven't rewatched that one yet, though, but I really want to. I want to see how it holds up.
Yeah,
plus,
I think the
deleted scenes look interesting, so I want
to
get the
blue. I didn't get a chance to see those because it was through Redbox, but and of course the only other thing would be the third episode of AMC's Preacher,
right,
which I just finished watching right before this podcast. And
your thoughts?
Pretty good. Not as good as last week, in my opinion.
I agree.
It was I would say a little bit of a step back, but I still liked it more than I liked the pilot episode.
Oh, totally. No doubt about that. I actually, you know, I would agree with you mostly that this episode was a step back from last week's, but I think it gave us the only good Tulip scene thus far in the show, being since she was pulled over by the cops.
Yeah, that was a good scene. Unfortunately, they negated it by having a terrible Tulip scene at the gas station, which just, again, in my opinion, I'm just really struggling with
why you
what
like
division.
This character.
Yeah, she comes off so when she started giving Jesse, especially when they're on the side of the road, and she starts giving Jesse the speech about, oh, because you think I'm not smart enough to follow. I was like, at that point, it was almost Seinfeld gift for me until they moved to the next scene. Like, I honestly didn't pay attention to the rest of what she was saying, because the minute that it's like dropping the Hitler bomb in a conversation. It's like once that happens, it's like, all right, we're really not going to get anywhere productive here. I really don't get. What they're going for with Tulip in terms of, yes, you want to give her a hard edge, but there's a difference between being a hard edge and just being a bitter, unlikable jerk of a person. Yeah, bitch, yeah. And that's kind of what they're making her right now, and I don't really get it.
Which isn't to say that Comic Tulip does a little bit of that, but that isn't her entire character like this is.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse has that in him, you know, in the comic. All the characters.
And I thought they were starting to turn the corner with her a little bit for a few minutes because in that scene with the cop, I thought for the first time she actually showed that there was still a large part of her that actually deeply cared about Jesse and wasn't just doing everything to control him, but actually felt like, you know, she was doing what was best for him ultimately. I also liked when they revealed, you know, more of their backstory and why she was so adamant about him coming to help her.
Yeah.
I thought it made some more sense from a character perspective because it's almost like she thought if they eliminated the guy who started their relationship down a bad path on that day, that maybe she could restore it back to what it was. So it made sense from, you know, her being a broken woman almost like that. They had some things that were starting to work for me, and then they just, like you said, that scene at the gas station, specifically the scene where she's just screaming at this random guy for no adequately explained reason, like, it just makes her come off as this unlikable bitch.
The idea, Preacher is a love story, and the idea should never be, you should never be asking yourself, why would Jesse ever want to be with Tulip?
Right. You and that's never what I'm asking myself at this question. Point.
Yeah.
But while we're on the subject of Tulip, how cool was it when Tulip drops the map from the pilot off at the beginning of the episode with her mysterious middleman and her mysterious – or middle woman, I should say – and her mysterious middle woman takes it into a theater, takes it into the fourth annual Houston Snuff Film Festival, which got a big pop for me. And there's a certain guy who we never see the face of, a certain guy in a certain white suit with a certain wide-brimmed hat enjoying the snuff film festivities.
Yeah, that – for those who haven't read the comic, stay tuned. This guy is going to bring you pleasures the likes of which you've never known.
Pretty much.
Other than that, it was good. I liked all the other characterizations. Cassidy was great. I do love the idea that they're introducing the duality of Cassidy a little bit.
Right.
The duplicitousness of Cassidy a little bit. So,
because it's clear to me, good. I mean, or just what I got out of the episode, and we're in a little bit of spoiler territory here, but by the end, aren't you sure that, like, my reading of it is that Cassidy is trying to play both sides. He's trying to convince these two guys that he can help them so that ultimately he can take what's in Jesse for himself.
Right, I agree. Yep. But with all that said, I think we're still both interested in the season, it was a good episode.
What did you make of the scene with Odin Quincannon in his office when he was listening to the
squeals of the animals as they're being slaughtered?
Yes,
tremendous, absolutely tremendous.
It really was.
I can't wait to see exactly where it's all going. But Odin Quincannon is another character that's going to bring people a lot of pleasure once he gets going. I think the deal with Preacher is if you can stick with this early development stuff they're doing, because they are taking a little bit of a slow approach to it. If you can stick through it, you're going to be rewarded with some of the best characters you've ever encountered on television, at least in terms of entertainment value. So
right. I would completely agree. But with all that being said, you know, we've gone a little bit over here in our reading and watching segment. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to take a break a little bit early. And when we come back on the other side, we have our thoughts, our review in depth of Green Lantern Rebirth. And, of course, our special guest, Jennifer Smith. So be sure to come back on the other side of the break.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStationNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Traveling Fanboys Long Book Hunters podcast on Green Lantern Rebirth. We went a little long on our reading watching, as Nick mentioned before the break, but that's just how hyped we were to talk about how great Rebirth was and how great Old Man Logan was and how very bad Civil War II has been.
Come on, dude. Old Man Logan was like 30 seconds of that. Don't put that on me.
No, that's I'm just saying. And we also talked a lot about Preacher and the characterization of Tulip, and also the weird, you know, characters on the side that are coming in. So, all that being said, we're going to get to a universe that has its share of weird characters, Green Lantern. And joining us this week for the very first time is a special guest on our Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. So perhaps we need to rename it the Hard Traveling Fan People podcast this week, because we have Jennifer Smith joining us. Jennifer is a friend of mine and She has just recently read this book for the first time. But Jennifer, say hello to the people out there and tell them a little bit about yourself and your history with comic books.
Well, hello to the people. I consider myself and girl of the fanboys. So I appreciate you guys having me. Like you said, I'm new to this, but not new to love of characters. I guess like a lot of people that I know, I watched, you know, the X-Men animated series and the Batman animated series when I was young. Batman is my favorite, so of course, you know,
right, down Nick Salad.
That's because you're an intelligent human being, that's why.
Well, obviously. you know, and I always just loved superheroes. I watched all the Batman movies. I watched, you know, starting with Iron Man, everything that came out. I was always there. You know, when The Walking Dead got popular, that's pretty much when I started picking up comic books. Of course, I'm way too impatient to read anything week to week or month to month. So I waited until the whole compendiums got collected. I have all three of those.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Russell actually just lent me the first compendium. So we're going to try to do a long book hunt on that at some point in the distant future when we have time to read it.
We are actually planning, and this is ways down the road, so we don't want to tease too much. The month of October is actually going to be Walking Dead month. All four of our shows are going to be Walking Dead related that month, is the current plan anyway. So we'll see if that actually
comes
to fruition or not.
We might need to have you back on since you've been a Walking Dead fan from pretty much day one.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
And from what Greg tells me, you've got a little one there at home. So have you mentioned the animated series. Have you tried introducing him to Batman or X-Men?
It's funny. My child is one of those oddities where he thinks even superheroes are too mainstream. He's like a weird little boy. He loves YouTube videos, obscure things like that. So he's, you know, he knows I love it. He watched a little bit of Young Justice with me last night.
All right.
And I really enjoyed, like, telling him who all the characters were and what they were doing. And he sat and watched with me for a little bit. I was very proud of him.
Yeah, I've got,
as he gets older, he might get into it more.
Yeah, I can understand that. I've got two girls at home, but mine are young. I've got a 2-year-old and a 9-month-old, and the 2-year-old is starting to watch the Batman the Animated Series, and it actually holds her attention more than I thought it would. So, trying to start her young, but we'll see how that goes going forward.
That's good. I'm glad. My little niece just turned 5, and she loves Batman, and I bought her all Batman stuff for her birthday. I'm trying to at least get one of these children something. Hooked on something that I love.
Well, ours, yeah. What's great for parents of little girls now is that, especially from the DC side, Target now had DC Superhero Girls line, which is it's a line of superhero stuff exclusively aimed at young girls. It's great because it's the first time there's ever really been anything like that. So, like, Olivia has, she's got a Batgirl, she's got a Harley Quinn, she's got a Wonder Woman, she's got a Wonder Woman shield. She's got a lot of stuff, but she carries that Wonder Woman around pretty frequently, so that's kind of cool to see.
I love that stuff at Target. I spent like half a day in there just geeking out, wanting to buy all of those dolls.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not even for a kid, but for ourselves. That's
yes,
the thing.
Yes,
like,
I was like, I can't spend $100 on these for myself.
I gotta be honest, like, looking at both of them in the toy aisle, the Batgirl utility belt from that line is actually a lot cooler and a lot more detailed than like the Batman utility belt from the boy aisle. Like, it has more compartments and it actually looks more like a functional utility belt than the boy version does, so that's kind of cool. But
the way they make Batgirl look.
Yeah, it's a great look, and I'm you know, she's only 2, so she's not reading or anything yet, but when they did Free Comic Book Day, they had, you know, a Superhero Girls issue, and so I grabbed that for her, and she walked around with, you know, looked through it as long as it could hold up to the rigor of a 2-year-old, because, you know, paperback floppy comic, it fell apart pretty quickly, but she had it for a couple days. So, but we're getting kind of off topic here, so Greg, you want to focus us back on Green Lantern?
Well Jennifer, tell us a little bit about your history with Green Lantern. You're coming into this. Nick and I have been Green Lantern fans since we were in college, which has been, God help us, about 10 years, and for Nick about 8 years.
My first Green Lantern comic was the summer of 07. I told you I'll never forget it. So that's Yeah, 9 years at this point, something like that. Yeah, not, almost something exactly, like that. Almost exactly 9 years, because it would have been during summer vacation after my freshman year of college. So that would have been, yeah, that would have been nine years ago, almost exactly.
Yep, and for me, I've been off and on since I was a little kid, mainly off until about 12 years ago when this book came out. But Jen, what was your knowledge of Green Lantern before you picked up Rebirth maybe about a month ago and read it? What was your exposure to Green Lantern, and where were you coming at into this as a fan?
Well, to be honest, you know, I vaguely remember watching the movie with Ryan Reynolds, but I never really got a sense of, like, I didn't really fall in love with it.
You know, not many people did.
Not many people did. So don't feel,
you
bad
know, I am a Ryan Reynolds fan, but that didn't hook me at the time. But mainly, I met Greg, you, and of course Russell, who lent me the book. Started talking to you guys online and learning more about all of the DC stuff, mainly because I was very much a newbie to DC, especially. I didn't really have a whole lot of knowledge or anything until Greg or Russell was like, read this book. And then that was pretty much the beginning. So it hasn't been long at all.
Yeah, no, it's funny you mentioned that Russell lent you the book and that's kind of started your love of it, because I actually lent Russell the book and started his love of the Green Lantern mythos back when we were in college. It would have been probably around 2005. I would have been, what would I have been, a junior at that point. And I remember Russell and I had been talking about comics for quite a while. We had been friends for a while. And I just lent him this, I believe it was the hardcover of Green Lantern Rebirth. It might have been the trade back, but and pretty much started his love of the mythos. And but I know, Nick, you actually became a Green Lantern fan during Sinestro Corps War, which was the second part of the so-called Green Lantern trilogy. And that was a few years after the fact. When did you actually get around to reading Rebirth? Because I remember we talked a little bit about Green Lantern when we met, but you didn't really become a fan until you picked up that Sinestro Corps special and took off from there.
Right. So my experience with it was, as I said, freshman year of college, I come back, and my freshman year of college was kind of informative for me in terms of my comic fandom, because it was the first full calendar year of my life that I had a pull list. This also happened to be around the same time as Marvel was doing Civil War, which was kind of my foray into the major Marvel universe. And at that point in time, I was only reading Ultimate Marvel books, the Civil War stuff, and then on the DC side, I was only reading Detective Comics and Batman. And so, I've told the story before, but I'll tell it again in brief. I came home from college, you know, came home from my summer break after my freshman year, and was hanging out with some of my friends from high school, one of whom, Blake Davis, if he listens to this, I don't know if he will or not, but he actually, which in a cool nod or a cool tie-in to our other geeky obsession, he was going to school at Full Sail down in Orlando, which is now the home of the WWE Performance Center and NXT and all that kind of stuff. But this was back in the days before that, and he was going to school for video game design down there. And he was living close to what is widely regarded now. Like, if you look at these sorts of rankings and stuff, whenever they're ranked in various comic guides and whatnot, he was living close to what is considered by many to be one of, if not the best, comic book shops in this country. It's called A Comic Shop in Orlando. And when Sinestro Corps War, the one-shot that kicked off the event, came out, Ethan Van Sciver, the artist, actually came down and did a signing at that shop. And so my buddy, who wasn't reading Green Lantern at the time, wasn't really much of a Green Lantern fan. He was reading mostly, like me, mostly Marvel stuff. He was like, well, I mean, I buy the book for cover price and I get the autograph for free. I might as well. And so he went to the signing, got the book, read it, and absolutely loved it. And like, when I saw him that summer, he was like, man, I know you don't read a whole lot of DC stuff. You got to read this. You got to read this. And so hung out at his place for a weekend, and you know, everybody else kind of fell asleep a little early, and so I pulled the book out, and actually the first Green Lantern comic I ever read in my life was an autographed copy of Sinestro Corps War, the one-shot special that kicked it off. And I mean, like, I was hooked from that moment on. I told him the next day, I was like, dude, I don't understand a single thing that's going on, but I know I love it. And immediately went into...
That's how I felt, too.
Yeah, immediately went into the Empire Comics and Enterprise back when it was still running. The next week, and was like, hey, man, whatever that Sinestro Corps War thing is, I want it. I want it. And so I got that added to my pull list. And then once Sinestro Corps ended, Kelly, you know, recommended some other things for me to read, and obviously tops on that list was Rebirth, and I was able to pick up the trade paperback from him at that point. So that's kind of how I read Rebirth for the first time, and I got to be honest, kind of like Sinestro Corps War, the first time I read it, I loved Rebirth, obviously, but I didn't have that greater knowledge with the DC Universe. I didn't understand why characters like Green Arrow were heavily involved in this book. I didn't understand who Sinestro or what Sinestro's deal was other than the fact that he had been in Sinestro Corps War. I didn't understand, you know, the idea of Kyle being the only Green Lantern. There were a lot of things that were foreign to me, but it didn't prevent me from enjoying the book at all at the time. And obviously, in the years since, with each a subsequent reread, it just... it gets better and better because I know so much more about that history.
Yeah. Now that's an interesting point that we're going to get into a little bit later, because it is a book that is steeped in history. And I'm interested to see, particularly from you, Jennifer, how that affected your read of it. But before we get to that, I'll explain where I came into Rebirth or why I came into Rebirth, because the story has been told in our columns many times and in our podcasts about how I was a huge comic fan growing up. And then, around 1997, I stopped reading, and I didn't read a comic. I mean, I picked up some here or there, maybe, but I didn't read comics regularly for 5-6 years after that. Right at about 5 years, I guess. And I came back for the Batman Hush storyline. And at that point, I started buying Batman trades. And I was only keeping up with Batman. And then in one of those Batman books, probably during the Brian Azzarello, Eduardo Risso, Broken City story, there was an ad in there, and it said, and it was Hal Jordan, and it said, Hal is returning, and or Hal is back, or something like that. And for backstory on that, when I was a kid, when I was first reading comics, Hal Jordan was in the very first comic book I ever read, which was an issue of Superman from 1988. And it was Superman and Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, on the cover, and they were flying through what appeared to be a high school geometry project. And it was obviously not a high school geometry project, but that's what it looked like. So I was just fascinated by this at the age of 4 and decided to love comic books from there. So I've always had sort of a weird attachment to Hal Jordan, even though I didn't regularly buy Green Lantern comics, even though he didn't appear in most of the comics that I bought back then. The fact that he was in my first comic always made me, I guess, feel some sort of connection to him. So when they... turned him evil in the mid-90s, it kind of turned me off. And so the idea of bringing him back, I was like, you know what? I got to check this out just to see how he can do it and how they can redeem him, as we're going to get into in just a second. And so I was coming into this book as somebody who was looking for a hook, basically. I didn't realize it at the time. I thought I was just going to buy this comic and see how Hal comes back, and then I'll be done with it. And I ended up loving it so much that it actually brought me back into the greater comic book fold. Suddenly, I was interested in what was happening in the JLA. Suddenly, I was interested in what was happening in Superman. Suddenly, I was interested in what was happening in both Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps. And so it really turned my comic book reading life around and created the happy-go-lucky that you have today.
And that's what a time to be pulled back into, right? Because Infinite Crisis was not long after this. I want to say
Around the corner,
less than a year, right? Or maybe around 6 months, something like that.
Yep. Infinite Crisis, which we have called the best of the DC crossover events. That was right around the corner, and it was, in my opinion, just. And I'm my opinion is obviously colored by nostalgia and how it was at the time. To me, it's the most exciting time in DC history. Like, it was such a whirlwind of great creative runs at the same time. But before we get into the actual meat of this story, Green Lantern Rebirth, Nick, you have actually read, as we mentioned earlier, every Green Lantern story starring Hal Jordan.
I think that's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's one or two here or there I missed, or there may be a random issue where he crossed over with the Legion of Superheroes or the All-Star Squadron or something like that I sort of, you know, general lack of interest in the Legion of Superheroes or the All-Star Squadron. But, mostly, I would say.
Now, let's put this into historical perspective in terms of what Green Lantern Rebirth represented and why it was a big deal. Because to readers today, it probably seems like, well, what's the big deal? Hal Jordan's been Green Lantern. As far as we've known, he was Green Lantern in the movie. What's the big deal? We know how the Corps works. But it was not that way for quite a long time. For a period of 10 years, 11 years, the Green Lantern mythos was really shaken up.
Right. So the quickest and dirtiest version of this that I can give you. Let's see here. So obviously, you know, you had Hal Jordan, who was introduced as the Green Lantern in the mid-1960s during the Silver Age, kind of reclaiming that title of Green Lantern, but claiming a distinct version of the character from the old, you know, Alan Scott Golden Age Green Lantern.
Doibie Dickles.
With Doibie Dickles, of course, our beloved Doibie Dickles. But so you had that from about 1960, you know, fourth or three, somewhere in that range. I forget the exact year. And that carried through all the way up into the early 90s. And throughout that period, you know, Green Lantern, like a lot of characters, would wax and wane in terms of popularity. The late 80s kind of represented a low point for Green Lantern, to the point where he was eventually given just a backup in Action Comics Weekly, did not have his own title, you know, going on. He had Action Comics Weekly and a Green Lantern Corps quarterly title that would come out, and that was really it. And so DC decided to try and get some interest back in the character by giving him his own book again, and they launched in the early 90s, I want to say it was 91, and I may be off on the numbering on that, but it's somewhere in that time frame. Gerard Jones launched a Green Lantern series, and the conceit of the series that kind of set it apart from really all of superhero comics, to be honest, was that for the first time they were allowing Green Lantern to actually show age. Hal's temples began to gray. He was portrayed as the elder statesman of the DC universe, for lack of a better term, even though he, you know, came in distance after characters like Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, or even The Flash. So even though he was one of the younger Silver Age characters, he was allowed to represent the idea of aging in the DC universe. And it was actually, if anybody wants to go back and read some classic Green Lantern, I mean, obviously you can go back years and decades, but I always point to that Gerard Jones run in the early 90s as something that doesn't get nearly enough of credit for the concepts it introduced. I mean, around the same time, you had what is probably the definitive John Stewart story with Mosaic. You had a re-emphasis on Guy Gardner. This book actually kind of established Guy Gardner as we know him today, you know, the lovable asshole, for lack of a better term. And so that going on, and I thought, you know, granted I was 5, 6 at the time, I can't really speak to what the sales numbers were, but looking back on it, you know, I thought it was a pretty good book. And then, as Greg knows, and I'm sure Jennifer knows a little bit about it, Death of Superman came along, and probably surprised even DC itself with how big of a success it was. And around the same time, you also had the growing trend towards the anti-hero in comics. You had the rise of Venom in popularity over in the Spider-Man mythos. You had
Ghost Rider.
You had Ghost Rider. You had Image Comics getting ready to kick off in a big way with their mostly darker and grittier take on the superhero tale.
And so, even in DC, Lobo was at his peak in terms of popularity.
Lobo. And so all of these factors kind of came together. And so you had Death of Superman. You also had Nightfall over in Batman with Bane breaking Batman's back and, you know, Batman being replaced by a very edgy, very 90s, for lack of a better term.
Extreme
version of the character. And so DC started kind of looking around and going, well, what other characters can we revamp? What other characters can we shake up? And Green Lantern was chosen, and Gerard Jones actually had to kind of pretty much throw his story out the window. He had the legend goes, there's a version of the story called Emerald Twilight that is completely different than what we eventually got. That Gerard was going to use it not to overhaul Hal Jordan, but to overhaul the idea of the Green Lantern Corps and to kind of do what Geoff Johns wound up doing years later and kind of, you know, put the Guardians in more of an antagonistic role and just kind of give Green Lantern a new purpose and a new status going forward. DC didn't want that. They wanted something a little bit more drastic. So Ron Mars was brought on to write a story that saw Hal Jordan's beloved Coast City destroyed. Hal, distraught with grief, attempts to bring Coast City back using his ring. The Guardians tell him he can't rebuild his city because it's using his ring for personal gain, and they warn him that he will be stripped of the ring if he doesn't comply with their order. This sets him off on a rage, and Hal Jordan tears across the universe to Oa to have a face-to-face with the Guardians, beating down and murdering countless Green Lanterns along the way, all leading up to this big blow-off at Oa, where the Guardians, you know, take the nuclear option of releasing Sinestro from his prison to battle Hal Jordan. And Hal winds up breaking Sinestro's neck on panel, and then you know, stepping into the central power battery and absorbing all the power for himself, in the process becoming a character known as Parallax, which was then presented as a big, huge villain going forward. In the midst of all this, you had the Guardian Ganthet, who took the one remaining Green Lantern ring that Hal had not absorbed into himself, and he whisked it away to Earth and gave it to the first Earthling he came across, and that, of course, being Kyle, which set up Kyle Rayner as the only Green Lantern in the universe going forward. And so you had Hal as kind of a villain for a little while in events like, I believe it was Final Night, Greg, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And also Zero Hour. He was the main villain in Zero Hour, if I remember correctly. Wherein the conceit was that he was attempting to turn back time in an effort to restore Coast City and put the universe back the way he thought it should be. And so eventually in the event Final Night, Hal Jordan, something happens and the sun is about to be extinguished and everyone in the universe die as a result of the sun being extinguished. And Hal, in a final act of heroism, sacrifices himself, throwing himself into the sun and using his power as Parallax to reignite the sun. And for the most part, with the exception of a few little time travel and alternate universe stories here and there in the intervening years, that was the last we saw of Hal Jordan for the better part of 8 or 9 years.
Well, yeah, except for that important era that we're about to bring up, because actually one of Geoff Johns' very first assignments for DC Comics was a story called, was it the Day of Judgment, I believe was the name of it? Yes,
Day of Judgment.
And not one of Jeff's best works, let's be honest, but the overall result of it was at the end of this book, it was an attempt to somehow, in some way, restart the path of redeeming Hal Jordan before Jeff really had the power to do that. So what they did was they actually made Hal Jordan the new host of the Spectre, who in DC Comics, the Spectre is literally God's wrath, and he inhabits a human host, traditionally a human host, and the human host grounds him to keep him from going, you know, insane. But he goes out and he punishes those who deserve punishing, basically. So Hal was the Spectre. And he popped up in Kevin Smith's Green Arrow a couple times in a pretty notable – he also popped up in Geoff Johns' Flash run to help out Wally West in a pretty major way as well. That all sets the stage for Green Lantern Rebirth. And what Green Lantern Rebirth was basically attempting to do was – you have to keep in mind you'd had Kyle Rayner as the sole Green Lantern for years. And there had been a few – flirtations with new Green Lanterns. Like, I think Kyle gave a ring to Jade, his girlfriend at the time. I believe John Stewart had a ring given to him by Kyle and was able to join the Justice League. But there were still maybe, if you wanted to be generous, you could say there were two or three Green Lanterns left.
I think at some point John got a ring again, John Stewart, and I believe
yes.
Kilowog had one out there in the cosmos. But those were really the only two classic Green Lantern characters who had the ring.
The central power battery was mostly powered down. You know, it was a very barren universe in terms of Green Lanterns when you went from what used to be a force that had a protector in every corner of the universe. Now you got three or four people, really just one that has the most of the power. The other two have surrogate rings, basically. And what Rebirth was trying to do was bring back Hal Jordan and bring him back to a prominent position. In most people's opinions, he shouldn't have been taken out from so unceremoniously. I think the problem that fans of the mythos had was not so much that Hal was removed as Green Lantern in the main title. It was that it was done in a way that felt so out of character in terms of you don't just take him out of the book. You make him the most evil person in the galaxy. And so this was attempting to restore Hal Jordan, but more importantly, restore the idea of the Green Lantern Corps, because one of the things we've talked about in the past is it's important to maintain what makes characters and concepts unique in the world of comics, because there are so many Superman knockoffs, so many Batman knockoffs, so many Spider-Man knockoffs. What made Green Lantern different was it's an intergalactic police force. It's built on the idea of teamwork on a galactic scale. The fact that if you don't like Hal Jordan, well, there's John Stewart. If you don't like John Stewart, there's Guy Gardner. If you don't like Guy Gardner, there's Kyle Rayner. If you don't like Kyle, there's Kat Matui or Kilowog or Stell or all these incredible Green Lantern characters, Tomar Ray or Tomar Tu. So many incredible alien Green Lantern characters, all these fantastic worlds, and all of that felt like it was missing in the DC universe, which is a recurring theme in Geoff Johns' Rebirth titles, is there's always this feeling that something's missing and he's trying to restore it. So, Nick, would you agree with that assessment that this was attempting to restore essentially the entire mythos to the DC universe?
Absolutely. And it was also an attempt to restore Hal Jordan's sense of honor, you know, that a lot of fans felt like had been taken away by Emerald Twilight. The Emerald Twilight, while it's a good comic book story, I don't think it's a very good Hal Jordan story for that very reason. It never builds to that moment for Hal. It just kind of comes out of nowhere and doesn't make any sense when it happens. And so in that way, and that's what Geoff Johns is brilliant about. He loves to take old elements of continuity, elements of the DC universe that you've always viewed a certain way, and show you a new way to view them, shine a new light upon them, as it were. And so that's really what this is a way to reshape the events of not just Emerald Twilight, but kind of the entire Hal Jordan story of the 90s into something that doesn't feel out of place.
Right. Now, we've given a giant continuity dump on everyone listening to this. Jennifer, coming into it as an outsider, first of all, the first question I'll ask you is, did you know anything about Kyle Rayner before you read this book?
No, I did listen to a Geek History Lesson podcast on Kyle, but no, I hadn't read anything with him.
So you're kind of dropped into this book, and Kyle is the Green Lantern at the beginning. Was it a tough adjustment for you reading this? Did you feel lost, or did you feel that after a few pages you were able to catch on pretty quick?
Well, the one good thing about having this book is they have a Who's Who page. So that really helped me to go back and be like, wait, what is this guy? Who is he? What's happening? So they have a whole list of who everybody is and kind of their little background. That helped me a lot. But, I was just trying not to have any kind of preconceived notions or anything. I was just trying to roll with the story and just let it go and try to figure out as I went. So it wasn't that bad.
Well, cool. I'm glad. The Basil exposition method of, I suggest you just try to not think about it and try to enjoy the movie.
Exactly. I think that worked for me.
That's cool that it has the, I haven't read that paperback. I'm guessing, is it the paperback or the hardback that you have?
It's the hardback.
The hardback. See, I've never read the hardback. So that's cool that it has that Who's Who page in there for it. Because I know my wife has expressed an interest in reading stuff like the Kevin Smith Green Arrow. But, Greg, I think you can attest to this. That Kevin Smith Green Arrow, especially that first volume, is so steeped in DC continuity. And it doesn't have a primer in the pages of the edition that I have. That it's really like, I feel like I would spend more time explaining things to her than she actually take reading the book. That I'm like, you know, maybe we should. And so I've handed her Mike Grell Green Arrow and other Green Arrow stuff. And I'm like, one day I'll sit down and try to explain the entire landscape going into this book so you understand every aspect of the story. Because that's one that I didn't understand the first time I read it, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, it's good that books have that Who's Who sometimes, because it's really necessary for new readers.
Yeah, even in monthly comics, I like what Marvel does with that first page they have that kind of sets the stage for who the characters are and what's going on. But that's something that DC Trades have intermittently done, because I know I picked up the first volume of the David Goyer, Geoff Johns, James Robinson JSA, and it was published like maybe 2000, 2001, and it has a Who's Who page at the beginning, which I needed because I had no idea who these versions of these characters were going in. And it really helps. So that's cool. Jennifer, I'm glad to hear that. And I guess
I was also lucky in that I had, you know, a bunch of friends online who, if I got confused, could straighten it out for me real quick. And I could ask questions too. I felt comfortable, you know, clicking a picture of a page and saying, who's this guy? What's his deal? And I knew within a few minutes, somebody would tell me what was up with him.
Yeah, I think that was also a benefit I had, you know, my introduction to the Green Lantern mythos, like I said, was with the Sinestro Corps War. So I kind of came in the middle of this Geoff Johns epic. And, Greg, I know you can attest to this. Kelly, who used to run or used to operate Empire Comics and Enterprise, there might not be a bigger Green Lantern fan on the face of this planet than Kelly. And so I was coming into the shop pretty much every week asking questions about who this was or what this is or what's going on. And so by the time I finally came to Rebirth, I at least had some tangential knowledge of all these moving parts in the Green Lantern mythos.
Now, who was it, Kelly or was it me, that first dared explain to you the overwhelming concept of the Anti-Monitor?
I believe that was Kelly, because that would have been during Sinestro Corps.
True. If you can survive, Jennifer, the explanation of who the Anti-Monitor is and why he matters, then you can survive pretty much any comic book explanation, I think, outside of maybe Power Girl, which is – I don't even understand.
Outside of Jeremy Reynolds' explanation of the X-Men mythos.
Yes, our friend Jeremy has a go-to response when we ask him about the X-Men of, it's really not that complicated, and then proceeds to tell us for 2 hours why it's not complicated.
Yeah, 2 hours of intricate, like, well, then this person's clone traveled through time to have sex with their father and various other things like that. So, you know, it makes no sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, interdimensional incest, which again brings us back to Mark Miller, who's probably on his X-Men epic as we stand here right now, right, working on his interdimensional incest X-Men epic. Good Lord. Anyway, back on topic.
Hey, I'd read that.
Who wouldn't? The Greys and the Summers and the Gray Malkins and
plus,
whatever.
Let's be honest, we're all from the South. Who you know, we love us a good incest story every now and then.
You know, it adds a little flavor, a little color.
That's true. And sadly, probably in a lot of our bloodlines, too. So, but that's neither here nor there. Good Lord. From Green Lanterns to incest, folks. But in any event, I'm glad that you weren't that confused by the story, because there are a lot of characters in here. But I got to be honest, picking this up on this reread, and I have to mention this, just to put myself over for a minute, I actually got a chance to read it in the ABS version, which I picked up about 2 years ago. This finally gave me an occasion to crack it open, and it's beautiful. The overblown art pages, the triple cover designs. There's a slipcase cover. There's a hard slipcase cover, and then there's the actual book cover, and they're all original designs by Ethan Van Sciver, the artist, which I feel like I haven't mentioned yet. This book was written by Jeff Johns, which we've mentioned. It was drawn by Ethan Van Sciver and an army of inkers. And to my eyes, Ethan Van Sciver may be the definitive Green Lantern artist, and it's largely because of this book and his work in the Sinestro Corps War. Just iconic imagery. When I picture Hal Jordan, the image I most readily get is Ethan Van Sciver's Hal Jordan. Just incredible dynamic action scenes, dynamic poses. That the way that I associate Jim Lee with the X-Men is the way that I associate EVS with the Green Lantern characters. Would you agree, Nick?
Oh, yeah, totally. I don't know if you remember, oh, God, what was it, maybe a year and a half ago or so now, when we were back doing the column, we did a countdown of our top five Green Lantern artists, and I had Ethan Van Sciver number one on my list, but I think you went with Ivan Reis.
Yeah, it was very close between the two, and it really depends on what the week is that I'm writing such a list, because some weeks I might prefer Ethan Van Sciver, some weeks I'll prefer Rice. They're neck and neck for me, because they both worked on the Green Lantern stories that matter most to me personally, whether it be Rebirth, be Sinestro Corps, whether it be Blackest Night. So, yeah. Well, what did you think of the art, Jennifer? Did the art speak to you in any way, or did you find it confusing, or what did you think about the art?
Honestly, I really, really liked it. I would get distracted looking at it sometimes. It would take my attention away from trying to figure out what the story was, and I would just stare at the picture because it was gorgeous. The one towards the end where Hal knocks the shit out of Batman, I just busted out laughing.
one of the most iconic panels, I think, from the book.
Oh my God, it's great. And I think what helped me with the story was the images of Parallax and Hal and Spectre. There's several where they're all ripping at each other, basically. And that was just very arresting to me. You know, I would just look at it and, you know, I was just really awestruck by it.
yeah, it's. I'm glad you mentioned that. That was an interesting,
images, yeah.
Yeah, artistic vision that I don't think anybody has really captured since. Recently, some artists in Green Lantern were trying to capture that feel with Parallax, and it didn't really work as well. He almost draws this image of a physical manifestation of Hal's multiple personalities pulling him apart. The influence
exactly
of Parallax,
right.
The influence of the Spectre, and then his own strong personality. That I'd say that those images, the ones you mentioned, Hal punching Batman and that image of them pulling themselves apart, are some of the images that stand out most from Rebirth all these years later. Because we've often run into the few people that we encounter that don't like the John's Green Lantern run often point to Parallax as, oh, the fear bug. Because if you just look at it on paper, it sounds stupid. But when you see it in execution, it's brilliantly executed. And
I think
the art was a big factor of that.
I don't think the fear bug sounds any stupider on paper than magic rings powered by willpower. Like, I mean,
I agree.
That's my issue with, like, people, especially, you know, we've talked about this before, people who have issues with hokey concepts and comics. And I'm like, if you're reading superhero comics, it's all hokey at a certain level.
Yeah.
Unless all you're reading is Batman, and even a lot of that's pretty hokey. So that...
I mean, the idea of a guy dressing like a bat and all, I mean, you have to suspend your disbelief.
Right. And so I don't... You know, I've never bought into that. I think, you know, the Parallax fear bug entity thing was a really good way to have your cake and eat it too. It was a good way to still maintain the events of Emerald Twilight while also providing a way to make, to not just redeem Hal, but almost make it like he never really needed to be redeemed in the first place.
Yep.
Right.
Even though in the eyes of contemporaries he did. So you keep that compelling angle going of he still, on some level, is trying to prove himself to Batman that he's legit, even though he says he's not. Because Batman just refuses to believe that,
yeah.
Because he has, you know, he can't wrap his head around these otherworldly concepts. He's a scientist.
And,
he's not a magician or anything like that.
And that idea
so
of redemption is one that carries forward into Geoff Johns' run, because, you know, when they bring back the core, it's eventually revealed that there's this pretty even mix of Lanterns who had served previously alongside new Lanterns. And so you had this group of Lanterns that Hal was serving alongside who remembered his past, and you had this group that didn't. And him trying to win everybody over was a big focus of that book leading up into Sinestro Corps War for the first
Sinestro Corps War with
issues or so.
Yeah. The climax of Sinestro Corps War kind of pays that off with that iconic issue where the whole city lights up. And it's that moment where he realizes that he's finally redeemed himself. But one of the things that's interesting about this Absolute Edition is at the very back of the book, they have two things that are really cool. They have the script to issue number one by Geoff Johns, and they also have the original pitch that he sent in I believe, 2003, the pitch that he sent to Dan Didio and DC Comics about what his overall view of this miniseries was. He has it broken down issue by issue. And one of the things he says at the very beginning, he puts out his goals for the series. And he says, first of all, if Hal Jordan had killed one person, you can redeem him. And you can make it a redemption story where the idea is to absolve him of that murder. However, Hal Jordan killed literally dozens and dozens and dozens of people. He said, you can't redeem him. He said, let's get that out on the board right now. There's no way to absolve him of that. So what we have to do is we have to come up with a way to do that from a story perspective in terms of we can't tell the story of Hal saying, I'm sorry, guys, forgive me, because that can't be forgiven. Instead, we have to make it revealed that Hal wasn't responsible for his actions. That's the only way he can be redeemed from that. That was one of the expressed goals going into this book, was to get Hal back in a hero role in a believable way that would open up the door for something else. And in the process of that, you can see as he develops the idea of what Parallax is, what it represents, and it opens up the idea of the emotional spectrum. And Jennifer, that's something that I also wanted to ask you about. What did you think about the positioning of willpower versus fear in this book and the idea of the emotional spectrum? Because this was all, at this time, these were new concepts to the Green Lantern mythos. This was stuff that had not existed before. It was stuff that Geoff was using to kind of retroactively explain things in the Green Lantern books. But what did you make of that whole dichotomy represented by Parallax versus the green energy of the Green Lanterns?
You know, I thought it was interesting. You know, I'd kind of picked up on a couple of times where they said, you know, my ring doesn't work on yellow. And they didn't know why, and then kind of discovered why. It's because of Parallax being yellow. You know, it's interesting. And I know that there's a whole, you know, a list of emotions that equate to different colors. I find that very interesting. You know, it works. I think it works.
Yeah, it kind of opened up the idea to a way to expand the Green Lantern universe in a way that I don't think anybody really thought of before, in terms of
right.
Now you did open it up. And this is really just the beginning. So in Rebirth, you don't really see the hints of, for instance, the Red Lanterns or Larfleeze the Orange Lantern or any of those other characters. But it opens the door for that because, as Geoff Johns does so well, it's about planting, respecting what came in the past and planting the seeds for growth. What were some of the – you mentioned actually a couple of the scenes that stood out to you, but what were some of the moments that stood out in this book to you, that be positively or negatively?
I liked the stuff with Kyle. I liked when he was explaining to Ollie the things that he had seen and what he had put together and why he was toting Hal's body around. You know, I liked you know, of course, Batman's my favorite, so I always tend to notice his moments where he's always in shadow in this book until somebody blasts him with green light, and he's really a dick most of the time.
This was during
that's
funny you mentioned this. This was during an era that Nick and I refer to as paranoid Batman, which we love,
yes.
But it's. Yeah, what did you make of that take on Batman?
I tend to like it too, you know. I like me some dark, kind of douchey Batman. You know, he's not doing it for unknown reasons. He has reasons, you know, for being how he is. He has trust issues, to say the
he's
least.
He's seen some shit, yeah.
Yeah, that no doubt, he's seen some shit. You know, and I really liked the ending. I liked the moments between Ollie and Hal, because I know they have a history. I don't know much of their history together, but I know that they do have a history and a friendship. I liked their scenes. Of course, I love Ollie.
I was going to ask, you obviously became a fan of Ollie through the series Arrow. What did you make of this version of Ollie? Did you recognize him? And did you you mentioned that you enjoyed his scenes. Was that an easy transition for you to read this version of Ollie?
Oh, yeah. I liked his banter. He told Sinestro he liked his facial hair at one point. Thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, when he's talking about trimming his mustache. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's kind of like me. You know, he didn't know any of the story. I kind of felt like I was, you know, going along with Ollie a little bit parts of it because he had to have Kyle explain all this stuff. And then he sat there and he was like, I need a minute, you know.
Yeah. You know. A lot of times his response is kind of like, right.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so what you're telling me is my friend is not evil. He just got, you know, kind of infected with this guy, and this guy took over his soul, so.
And this other guy took over his soul, but then the other thing took over the other guy's soul that took over his soul,
right.
And then, yeah.
That's
what were you saying,
so,
Nick?
That's one thing that's easy to forget when you like, I think we all are in a big run of just watching Arrow and not really reading a ton of Lantern comics lately, is Ollie can be a damn funny character when he's used properly. And that's one aspect that I think they've started to try to introduce that into the show, but they haven't really gone full on comedic with Ollie yet, you know, and it probably wouldn't even fit in the tone of the show, but he can be a downright hilarious character when used like he is here in Rebirth. So I love his usage here. To echo what Jennifer said, Batman almost in a good way comes across as the third villain of the piece. Cause obviously you have Parallax and you have, Sinestro, but you have Batman, who is sowing the seed of discord, I guess you could say, within the Justice League. And like she brought called attention to, Van Sciver always drawing him in shadow to represent that that dichotomy between, you know, the light of the Green Lanterns and Batman's operation in darkness, and, you know, his cynicism of the world towards the world, which was at its all-time high, leading into Infinite Crisis, like we said earlier. So all good points that she brought up, and some of my favorite stuff about the book as well.
Yeah, there's this great point. It's interesting you mentioned that about him being a third antagonist. There's this line of dialogue, and I'm looking at it right now, where Parallax has taken over Ganthet, the Guardian, and it all is not looking very good for our heroes. They're in a bad position, and as the Parallax-infected Ganthet is staring down at all the heroes below, he says, "Hungry for you, victims of fear, and yet I sense a worshiper, a disciple," and the panel focuses in on Batman. And it illustrates that of all the characters, and honestly, I don't think I'd ever picked up on that until this most recent read, but the disciple is not Sinestro. It's not Arkillo or one of the members of the Sinestro Corps. The disciple of fear is actually Batman, because think about it, he traffics in fear. I mean, that's the whole idea of Batman, is that criminals are a cowardly and superstitious lot, so he's going to instill fear in them. So I thought that was really cool. Did that bother you at all as a Batman fan, Nick?
No, not at all. I mean, the idea of Parallax, that he's fear incarnate, so somebody who instills fear would obviously be considered by Parallax as a disciple. And it's really cool that, you know, down the road in Sinestro Corps War, you almost have a callback to that, because one of the first people we're shown on Earth being offered a Sinestro Corps ring is Batman. So that's a cool link between these two stories.
One of the things that was interesting that you mentioned, Jennifer, is you really loved Kyle's role in this story. This is the controversy about Rebirth. It's universally beloved, but a lot of Kyle Rayner fans resent Rebirth because they feel like it was in some way belittling Kyle's role in the mythos. They thought that they demoted him from the main Green Lantern, obviously, but they viewed it as I've seen it bandied about online that Reef was basically character assassination on Kyle Rayner. I didn't find that to be the case at all. I thought it was actually a great Kyle Rayner story, the best Kyle Rayner story, maybe. To me, he's the main character for the entire first half of the book, I would argue. He's the main narrator anyway. What were your thoughts on Kyle in the book? And I'll get to you in a minute on that too, Nick, because I know you have some strong thoughts on that.
No, I honestly don't see that, you know, and, you know, that's not knowing anything. I never felt that way. And, you know, I really like I said, he kind of helped guide me through, you know, he gave backstory. He said, this is what was going on. He seemed to be one of the only people that believed that this was really happening to him, to Hal. You know, he had gotten the story. So, you know, I don't really see how it looks. I don't think it looks bad on him. I don't think he's been replaced. I mean, at the end, they had a nice moment when they introduced themselves. You know, I liked that a lot.
Yeah, the handshake.
Yeah.
After all that fighting, they finally whip Sinestro and then take the moment to shake each other's hands. Yeah, really
exactly.
Cool.
Exactly. I mean, I thought it was great.
And we also get these killer shots at the end. These great splash pages of all of the lanterns working together. And one of the things that I've always loved about Rebirth is how it illustrated the differences between the lanterns, that each one of them uses the ring differently. Like it mentions that when Guy Gardner uses it, it's like a leaky faucet. It's just so sparkling with willpower. When Kilowog uses it, he uses it like a cannon. He's the only Green Lantern that makes a noise when he uses his ring. John Stewart is an architect, builds all of his constructs from the inside out, and Kyle Rayner is an artist, so he's always sketching out these elaborate designs that constantly change. Was that something that also you thought was cool, Jennifer, the way that they differentiated, I guess, between the characters?
Yeah, I really like that. I'm actually looking at that right now, too. It's perfect. You know, it gives you a little something, like you said, for everybody. There seems to be a personality that would fit you. If you looked at these pages, you can clearly see how the guys are different, but they work together. Turn the page, and then you know, they're all working together using their power as one. And I'm a sucker for a team, so I really, really enjoyed that.
Now, Nick, I'm going to get to you. First of all, address the Kyle elephant in the room, because obviously Kyle had been the Green Lantern for 10 years, and all of a sudden he's now a Green Lantern. What do you make of the general complaint, and what's your theory about why that has kind of retroactively been applied to Rebirth?
My theory about why it's been retroactively applied, I'll tell first, is because, you know, in the years since Rebirth, I think it's fair to say that you know, Hal did kind of become the main Green Lantern. He was the Lantern focused on most heavily in the main Green Lantern title. At times, you even had Kyle taken even the secondary title, Green Lantern Corps, and moved over into something like New Guardians, which I think clearly a lot of people viewed as the tertiary title, or even most recently, what was it, the Omega Men, which wasn't even really a Green Lantern title at all. And so I think that
most of that was in the New 52, I think.
That's true,
when they
moved
him out of the GLC book.
Don't forget that he also was put into an Ion book not too long after
true.
This. And also was infected by Parallax during Sinestro Corps War. So I think that, you know, the things that happen to Kyle in the next 7 or 8 years coming out of this tend to unfairly color people's perception of this story by itself. I mean, look at the scene when Sinestro and Hal are clashing for the first time since Hal's return, and Sinestro is verbally running down Kyle. And the entire time, Hal is telling Sinestro all of the reasons he's wrong, and all the reasons why Kyle, above anybody else, is responsible for keeping the Light of the Lanterns burning in the universe. He was the only guy left. They take numerous occasions throughout this story for Hal to directly praise Kyle, and I think it's one of those instances, much like in DC Universe Rebirth recently, where it's almost Geoff Johns speaking directly to the reader, telling the reader, this isn't intended to replace Kyle or diminish Kyle. This is intended to just make Kyle part of the larger mythos. And that's really what the story was intended to do. It was never intended to take away Kyle. Again, to make a parallel to DC Universe Rebirth, it's the same thing with New 52 Wally and pre-Flashpoint Wally. Just because pre-Flashpoint Wally is back now doesn't mean that Geoff Johns was trying to erase New 52 Wally for whoever may be attached to him, and that was the same thing here. He was acknowledging Kyle's contribution to the mythos and his contribution to the Light of the Green Lanterns while also simultaneously restoring some aspects of the Green Lanterns that Geoff Johns clearly cared about deeply.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with all of that. It also established the long-running gag of Sinestro calling Kyle an alley rat that got played off Ron in the Green Lantern mythos when I'll spoil this for you, Jennifer, because you probably won't get there for a while. Kyle ends up dating Sinestro's daughter at one point. So
nice. It
leads to quite a few entertaining exchanges.
Didn't Ganthet find him peeing in a back alley?
Outside a bar, yeah.
Yep.
Nice.
That's exactly right.
This is where the alley rat knock on Kyle from by Sinestro came from.
Mm-hmm. it's one of the more interesting origins in the GL mythos. All of them have really interesting, sometimes bizarre origins, whether it be Hal, you know, guy getting the ring because he was originally going to be the Green Lantern of Earth, but Hal was closer. John Stewart being the replacement Green Lantern. You know, there was just a lot of interesting backstory there.
Guy's amnesia.
Yeah, that Guy Gardner. We could do our own podcast on Geigner and going from there. But that's one of the things we haven't talked about is we've said that this is not a – this story is not a nostalgic step backwards. This is an additive story. This is about adding to the mythos and expanding it. This is not about reducing it. By definition, you had one Green Lantern, and now you have 3,200, whatever.
3,600,
yeah. So, you know, eventually after the Recharge storyline. So we haven't talked, though, about the other thing that this book restored, which is the character of Sinestro. Because as far as it sounds to new Green Lantern fans when you talk to them and you try to explain to them, there was a 10-year gap in DC Comics where there was one Green Lantern who did not have the Guardians to answer to, who had no teammates, and who had Nostro. Sinestro was a non-entity for about 10 years. So what did you guys think? And I'll start with you, Nick, coming at it from a historical standpoint. What did you think of the way that this book reintroduced Sinestro, and how did it compare to the older characterizations of Sinestro, which even I'm not that familiar with?
Well, I mean, it's really brilliant in a way because it almost reshapes Sinestro as the true mastermind of everything that befell Hal. Yes, Parallax was the one that infected him, but Sinestro was the one who woke him up. Sinestro was the one who pointed him in Hal's direction. And Sinestro was the one who was able to convince Hal that he had killed him and really solidify that delusion in Hal's mind. So just a great – it's the best example of retconning, you know, that you can come up with. What is interesting to me is that for about the last, I'd say, 25 years now, we've been – it's almost like weaning Sinestro off the steroids that led Barry Bonds-like head, because from Emerald Twilight, you know, in the 10-year gap between Emerald Twilight and Rebirth, as shocking as it may sound, his head got a lot smaller. And since Rebirth, his head has, like, slowly been shrinking to the point where now it just looks like a normal person's head, just purple. Yeah. So,
yeah, and I think that may have been to distinguish him from another character that returns in this book, who is the one of our favorites, Nick, and we may be alone in this, but Hector Hammond, the gigantic slobbering head. Jennifer, I have to ask before we get back to Sinestro, what were your thoughts on Hector Hammond and his very brief appearance?
Okay, yeah, I did not know who that was. I was like, what is this? I have no idea what is going on. That was probably the most lost I felt reading this book.
Well, but you've seen the movie, and Hector Hammond was in the Green Lantern movie, if you recall. He was the main villain of the piece that got infected by Parallax, by the meteor that came down.
I did not remember that, okay? I must have wiped all that out of my memory.
Yes.
So I did not remember any of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. We can't blame you. but yeah, Hector Hammond, he is in the Geoff Johns reimagining of Hector, his head is approximately four times larger than his body, it seems. And,
he's looking,
he's kind of like the DC equivalent of MODOK in that regard.
Yes. Yes. But the thing that's Hector Hammond really funny, and you'll read this as you go along in the Geoff Johns Green Lantern run, Jennifer, Hector has a – would it be fair to say, Nick, that he has a somewhat sexual fascination with Hal?
Yeah, especially with, like, wanting to experience the things that Hal has experienced. Like
Vicariously, yes.
Like, his ultimate fantasy isn't necessarily to do the things that Hal has done, but simply to have the memory of doing the things that Hal has done, if that makes any sense. Like,
yes.
He wants to be inside Hal's head and see all the women that – Hal has bedded and see all the planets that Hal has visited and all the villains that Hal has vanquished. He has a really bizarre fascination with Hal, is the best way to
say it. And he slobbers a lot.
Yes.
Looking at him right now. Yeah.
So he's a hilarious character, because there'll be points in the run where Hal will have to visit him for some reason or another, and he'll force Hal to give him a memory, and then he'll just sit there and just salivate over it like Homer salivating over a donut.
That's crazy.
Yes,
it is that,
very
but
creepy.
Funny at the same time.
Yes. Back on point to Sinestro, Jennifer. What were your thoughts on Sinestro in this book?
Well, I like Nick said, I liked how he is the ultimate architect of the whole scheme. You know, he's the one that's influenced Parallax to do the things that he's done, and you know, he was a creepy looking dude. I liked the dialogue too. Like you said, when he was talking smack about Cal, you know, I liked that part.
Yeah, he says, "I will slice the creature's open and rip out his useless heart."
Yeah, I mean that's pretty poetic, I gotta say. I mean he's not a low level villain. I mean, not knowing anything about him, I could tell he was badass.
And that's another change, because, Nick, I think you've mentioned to me before, but that Sinestro throughout most of the Silver Age and even into the Bronze Age was kind of a one-note,
mustache
not
twirler.
That interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, he would, you know, he would come up with these crazy Dr. Evil-like schemes to rob Hal of his power or trap him in the antimatter universe, and then...
I'm going to place him into an easily escapable antimatter universe and assume everything goes to plan.
That's exactly what he would do, and then he would just stand there and cackle and, like, you know, was kind of always easily defeated up until, like, probably the mid to late 80s when the writers that had him at the time, Steve Englehart primarily, tried to kind of redeem him a little bit and make him a little bit more sinister. And then Gerard Jones kind of continued that, but I think Jeff Johns was able to bring in the ultimate evolution of that course he had been on for a little while, making him truly, you know, he'd always been, I guess, Green Lantern's, you know, arch nemesis by default, simply because he had been there from the beginning. He was kind of the guy who appeared in the most stories. But, you know, those three writers, Englehart, Jones, and Johns, I think, were the ones that really took him and made him into a true, you know, a true nemesis for Hal and a true arch villain in all the best ways. And now, I mean, we live in a world where the character just carried his own solo title for 23 issues. We live in a world where, you know, Sinestro Quartet are being sold. I mean, it's the reclamation job.
There are strong
for that
arguments out there. There's a whole generation of comic readers who consider Sinestro, if not the best DC villain, then the number two villain behind the Joker. There's a whole generation of readers who consider him that because of this, you know, this modern approach to him.
Right, and that's, you know, that's thanks to Jeff Johns, really. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine a DC universe without Sinestro as a major player, but, you know, we're not even 10 years removed from a DC universe where that existed. So big kudos to Johns there for taking that piece and putting it back on the board in a big bad way.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that I noticed on this most recent reread is this book, without making it obvious, shows the beginning of some of the defining characteristics of the Sinestro that you and I, Nick, consider one of the greatest characters in the history of comics now, which is, first of all, I'll start visually. Van Sciver draws Sinestro in a way that, if you notice, he's always hovering over whoever he's talking to, because Sinestro doesn't view – yeah, he doesn't view anyone as being on his level. So he's going to – even though he's shorter than Hal and shorter than Kyle, he's going to be hovering above them every time they're talking, because – and especially when he's talking to a human, because that's how far below him he considers that entire race of people. He's somebody who is constantly going to be, like you said, looking down his nose at people. And that's something that gets started here by Van Sciver, who had a lot of great visual ideas that we'll get into in a minute. And then also – you also get just the briefest hint that there might be something beneath Sinestro besides just he's a villain. Because if you notice in his conversation with Hal while they're beating the hell out of each other, which is a great long-time comic book tradition of people talking more in fights than they would in real life. But Hal and Sinestro have this really in-depth conversation. And in the midst of it, you know, Hal says, "You abandoned the oath." And then Sinestro says, "No, the oath abandoned me." And he basically made it clear to Kyle earlier in the book that if Hal had just left him and his sector alone, they never would have been enemies. He never really had a problem with Hal until Hal stepped into his district and started telling him how to run things. And so it sets it up that in Sinestro's eyes, it's all about Korugar. It's all about, you know, protecting and keeping order in his homeworld, even though the means that he uses to do that are Hitler-esque and dictatorial. He is, in his mind, he's right, because he's looking out for the good of the universe, and he doesn't think that the Green Lanterns can do that weak. And it's just hinted at here, but it's something that you see going forward throughout Sinestro Corps War and into Blackest Night, that Sinestro does have some nobility about him. It's not just this generic mustache-twirling villain. He's a lot closer to being like Magneto than he is to being like the Joker.
Yeah, and very much like Magneto, he's primarily driven by a need and a desire to help his people. You know, he lost Korugar, and that was really his driving focus. You know, he views himself as, for better or worse, the sole protector of those people, and the greatest tragedy in all of it, or in his eyes, is that Hal didn't just take away that role, but he made him not a hero, but a villain in the eyes of his people. He made him a character to be feared by his entire race, something he never forgave Hal for doing.
And it really makes the kind of the poetic nature of this whole book shine through, in that his scheme is not to defeat the Green Lanterns or to destroy the Green Lanterns, but, I mean, that would be a plus for him. But the main goal is to put Hal through exactly what Sinestro went through, in terms of now Hal is the one who's considered the villain by his own people. Hal is the one who's not accepted by his own people. And that was Sinestro's plan the whole time. So it really establishes him as the biggest villain in the Green Lantern universe. It establishes him as an evil entity, but also an evil entity that has some cause to feel the way that he does. He's not just evil for the sake of evil, if that makes sense.
Right.
Now, back to those visual cues that I was talking about. One of the other things, in addition to the Sinestro hovering thing that Van Sciver introduces here, is the concept of the Green Lantern badges. And this is something that Nick and I have read about this book and the making of it that we knew about. Jennifer, did you notice at all the way that the lantern symbols seem to pop off chests of the characters almost into like their own symbols? That was the idea behind that, apparently, anyway, is that Van Sciver looked at it as they're an intergalactic police force. So this is sort of like their badge, basically. It announces to people, I'm a Green Lantern, I'm here. You know, it's the equivalent of when a cop shows up and flashes his badge, basically. So that's something that was – it's a minor detail. And in subsequent years, very few artists have chosen to do that when they draw the characters. But I thought it was so cool. I thought the level of detail and the level of – something so minor just showed the thought that was put into this story by writer and artist. What did you guys think?
I agree with that.
Yeah, you know my take on that, Greg. I've always loved that concept, and it's something that always makes it's weird because, you know, like we said, writer and artist put so much effort into it, but it almost feels like a uniquely Van Sciver contribution to the myth of that. I know it's been done other places, but it never seems to pop the same way when anybody other than him is doing it.
And that kind of bridges into a question that I have for you, Jennifer. For me, I think it was the intergalactic police force idea of the core that most spoke out to me at first, that drew me into the Mythos. What is it about Green Lantern, if anything, that interests you the most about the concept of Green Lantern?
I'm kind of with you on the intergalactic police force idea. Also the willpower idea, mostly because that's something I don't seem to have a lot of. So I'm very interested in the idea of gathering that to use it as a force. You know, it's interesting. It's not a superpower like with gamma rays or anything, but it's not toys, even though they have rings. You know, the willpower comes from themselves and they manifest it. I think that's very interesting. It seems like something real, you know, even though they're intergalactic, you know, they have this real human type quality.
So yeah, something that grounds them to the human experience.
And right.
What's interesting is it sets it up in a way that anyone can understand, because we've all felt fear before.
Right.
And you can either give in to your fear or you can overcome it. And Green Lantern is all about overcoming that fear. And that's the way that Jeff always describes it when he describes Green Lantern, is at its core, it's about it's about overcoming fear and through willpower. So that's pretty cool. What about you, Nick? What about the Green Lantern concept speaks to you? I know that there's a lot of things, but distill it down. What was it that spoke to you that kind of sucked you in to the Green Lantern mythos?
I guess it's the fact that it almost feels like a universe within a universe. Like, you have the DC universe,
yeah.
But then, like, and the DC universe is made up of thousands of interesting characters and stuff, but the Green Lantern subsection of that alone is just as deep and just as vast as, you know, the rest of the DC universe in its entirety, because you've got literally thousands of lanterns and thousands of sectors and thousands of worlds, and it's just, it's so vast. You can take it literally anywhere. It's the closest concept in comics to Star Wars, you know. That's kind of my end to it, is that that Sinestro Corps one shot, Sinestro Corps War story, it was like, I was reading it, I was like, man, this feels like Star Wars viewed through the superhero prism. And so that was kind of my entry point into it, and that's always kind of been the thing that keeps me coming back.
Yeah, no, that's a great analogy. And it's funny you mention that, because when I first read Green Lantern Rebirth, and it just kind of like popped in my mind the concept of the Green Lantern Corps in a way that it never did when I was a kid even. And I think what it was the way I described it to Russell when I first lent him the book is, I'm like, imagine Star Wars meets Lord of the Rings meets James Bond, and you've kind of got the Green Lantern Corps like rolled up into one, because there is the idea of the ring having all the power and all the different lands and the people that want the ring and the power. There's also the idea of the warring kingdoms, the warring factions in space, the Jedi and the Green Lanterns. There's a lot of parallels there. And then from the James Bond aspect, you get the sort of swashbuckling Hal Jordan character that's more of the Captain Kirk type of character, you know. Jennifer, did you see any parallels between Star Wars, particularly the Jedi and the Lanterns?
Not initially, but the more I think about it, the more I do see it. And, you know, this is part of the reason why I am a fangirl of you guys, is because y'all make me think about things that I never really considered. And I'm looking at the pages, you know, there's a lot of spacey stuff. I like it, you know. I to me, it makes even more sense why I like Green Lantern now, because I love Star Wars. It makes sense.
And that's something that I think speaks to a lot of people. Real quick, let's talk about a favorite individual scene. Start with you, Jennifer. You've talked about some of yours, but what was your – if you had to pick one, what was your favorite scene in the book?
Like you said, there are a lot. But, I mean, the thing with the most reaction out of me was when he punched the shit out of Batman. I mean, it's just – I never see – like, you know, you see Batman get beat up, but – I mean, that was a one punch. He was down. It was over. And everybody around just went, damn. You know?
The Friday moment, yeah.
It was great. It was great.
And there's actually a line of dialogue that wouldn't make sense to you because you haven't read the 80s Justice League. But one of the moments that kind of in 80s DC was, there's a moment in the original Justice League International series when it was known as Justice League America, I think, and or just Justice League maybe, I don't remember, but anyway, in the JLI series, yeah, where Guy Gardner is running off at the mouth, as he often does, and Batman walks up to him and knocks him out with one punch, and everybody starts laughing at Guy and says one punch. So in this one, Hal's Batman out with one punch, and then Guy's like, did you see that? One punch.
One punch.
And then all of a sudden, Guy – who hates Hal Jordan more than anybody, Guy's like, you know what? I always loved you, Jordan. So, Nick, what about you? What was your favorite moment in Green Lantern Rebirth?
Oh, man, that's tough. I'm going to go with – because it gets across so well just how difficult it is to be a Green Lantern. It's the moment when Ollie uses the ring, and he makes reference – he asked Kyle something like, is it always that hard? And Kyle says something to the effect of every time. And it shows you that there's more to a Green Lantern than just the ring. It really is about the man or creature or woman who wields it as well.
That's such a great scene. You're right. And that's one of my favorites as well, because it really does illustrate. I mean, it puts into context just how cool these characters are. But my favorite scene would be the one that I mentioned earlier about this. It's near the end of the book, and it's when the big five Lanterns, which is Guy Gardner, John Stewart, Kyle Rayner, Hal Jordan, and Kilowog, launch their attack on the Parallax entity. And basically, panel by panel, they explain who these characters are and what makes them different, because not all Green Lanterns are the same. They're all unique. They all use the ring in different ways. And correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, but this was really the first time that we'd seen that explored, that each Lantern's ring acts in a different way.
They had done a little bit with it during the Gerard Jones run. Like I said, during Mosaic, they play up the architect aspect of John Stewart, and so kind of move that over into the way he used the ring. But they had never really explored it from the standpoint of every single Lantern uses it differently. It had kind of been presented as, well, this is just what makes John special, not necessarily makes him what makes each Lantern unique, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and by proxy, it makes every Lantern special. what they did with Rebirth. And it's one aspect that I wish that more Green Lantern writers would focus on, because I feel like it hasn't kind of been focused on in recent years. But, and last question before we wrap up and give our overall thoughts, favorite character in the book other than Hal Jordan? Jennifer?
I got to go with Green Arrow.
Very, very good. That's a lot of great lines in it. Nick?
As it always is, Guy Gardner.
Oh, so good. For those that, real quick, tell me why Guy Gardner has always been one of your favorites. He's one of my favorites, too. We bonded largely over Guy Gardner and our mutual love of the Green Lantern mythos. Because a lot of people hate Guy.
To me, he's the definition of a lovable prick. Like, if I knew the guy in real life, I would probably never want to be around him. But he's a endlessly fascinating character to read. Much like Cassidy and Preacher are on the TV show. It's, you know, endlessly entertaining, but not necessarily the greatest person on the face of the planet. But one of the reasons I've become endeared to him over the years is because, as Greg knows, coming out of this, Peter Tomasi and Jeff Johns would do some great work with Guy, helping him to evolve beyond being just a comedy character and being a guy that had a lot of those at his core as well. And so it's just a great example of taking a character and a concept that had been one note and making it something more.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's like, in some ways he's like a great heel in wrestling, you know, like Hollywood Rock or something, where, you know, you're like, God, I would hate him in real life, but he's so great in fiction and so entertaining. And I just can't take my eyes off of any page that he's on. And even to the degree in this book, there's a line where, according to Kyle Rayner's interior monologue, Guy refers to the longtime Green Lantern villain Sonar as a quote candy ass.
Yeah.
which popped me as a wrestling fan. And for me, I was going to go Guy as well. I'm just, this book put Guy Gardner back on the map and brought back the guy that I remembered from when I was a kid, when I always loved him as that guy you love to hate, because for many years he was Guy Gardner Warrior, which is another story for another time, but he was basically off the map as a major character. He had a weird power set, and it just didn't make a whole lot of sense. But this was a return to the guy of old, and also to the John Stewart of old, and all these great Green Lantern characters and concepts. Now, final thoughts. Jennifer, again, I'm going to start with you. You were coming into this universe as an outsider. What were your thoughts on Green Lantern Rebirth as a whole, and did you find it in any way a hook to read more Green Lantern, or did you see it as like it's a good one-off story and I'm done?
No, I'm definitely not done with this. I it's a lot of conflicting emotions because, there's a lot that I want to go back and read now. I want to know the original story. I want to know, you know, what happens after this. So it's for somebody like me, you know, who doesn't know much of anything. I think it's perfect. I couldn't think of anything better that to get me started. You know, honestly, it's great. I just really loved it.
Awesome. Yeah, it's a great starting point because one of the great debates right now among hardcore Jeff Johns Green Lantern fans is, do you start a new reader with Secret Origin or do you start a new reader with Rebirth? And for a while, I was leaning towards Secret Origin, but having talked to you tonight, I think maybe Rebirth is the best way to start someone out. What do you think, Nick?
Especially if you have this hardcover edition with the, you know, the who's who, that would help a lot. And, in the new Rebirth, the Green Lanterns Rebirth, I'd pick that up. But just because I had read this, you know, and now saw that the female was Jessica was the main character or one of the main characters. Very interested in the female because let's face it, this is a sausage fest book. And,
it is.
You know,
that's true.
We need some chicks. You know, we need some girls. I know there are other girl Green Lanterns, but you know, I would say reading this directly influenced me buying, you know, into the new one.
Very cool. Very cool. What do you think, Nick? Overall, obviously, we're going to skip the part where we both talk about it's awesome and everyone should read it. But what do you think about it as an introduction to the Green Lantern mythos to new readers, Nick?
You know, it's tough to say at this point because it's been so long since I've had that perspective. But I think like most John stories, especially his Rebirth stories, it does a good enough job of laying the groundwork through expositional dialogue and through flashbacks that I think it can serve as a very good introduction for new readers. Would I recommend it over Secret Origins necessarily? I don't know. I think Secret Origins is kind of a perfect origin story. So I might lean go Secret Origins first and then come back and do Rebirth. But you really can't go wrong with whatever reading order you choose to tackle Geoff Johns' Green Lantern.
Yeah, and Jenny, you've got enough people here locally that between me and Russell that have the entire Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run. We will try to get it to you in order because it really does work better if you read the whole thing in order. Nick and I consider it.
I'm up for that.
Among the, among or if not at the top of the best superhero comics ever written. So, it's a great run. Anyway, folks, we've talked a lot about Green Lantern Rebirth, and that's just because it is a book that means a lot to the two of us, and it was great to hear the passion from Jennifer today about this book because we're so ingrained in it, and it just kind of. Come second nature to us, but to hear a new fan come in and kind of geek out over some of these cool concepts is really awesome. Real while I'm thinking about it, though, Nick, where would this stack up in your Green Lantern story rankings? Roughly. Obviously, we can do another countdown another time, but just roughly, would this be top three, top five, top 10?
Top five. I'll say top five because I know it's behind Blackest Night and Sinestro Corps War. And then you start getting into stuff like, Emerald Dawn, which a lot of people forget about, Secret Origins, things like that. But I'd say it's solidly top five.
And one of the – I would agree with that. It's top five for me, maybe top three. Because honestly, this most recent reread, I haven't read this book in probably 3 or 4 years, and it really made me fall in love with the book all over again. And Jen, I can't wait for you to encounter Larfleeze one day, my favorite – side character in the Green Lantern universe. So that'll be cool.
I can't wait either.
Well, thanks for being on, by the way. We appreciate having you on. This is the first time we've had a guest. I hope we didn't dominate the conversation too much.
Are you kidding? Thanks for having me. I mean, mostly I'm just sitting here like I would normally listen to you guys in a podcast, and I'm like, oh yeah, I get to talk to them this time.
Well, cool, Jennifer. We'll definitely have you on again. Nick, any messages we should send the listening public before we sign off tonight?
Just the typical, hit us up on the Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook. Subscribe to the Pop feed. It's still in its infancy, so we want to get those subscriber numbers up. And there's tons of good stuff across there, not just our show. You got Imaginary Stories, you got Lucha Undead, you got Seller's Points, you got Weber Has Issues Conversation Comics, Todd's Show of Doom title thing. That's always good. And of course, cheap plug for me and Todd. We recently sat down and did a little Aquaman show with Russell on his latest edition of Sellers Point. So referenced that earlier in the show, but be sure to check that out. And then of course,
and also, yeah, I was going to say, Glenn Butler's podcast where he delves into a variety of topics. And he will actually be our guest next week when we count down our favorite comic book television and movie themes and scores. So that promises to be an interesting dichotomy between the very limited in musical knowledge Greg and Nick and the extremely potent in musical knowledge Glenn Butler. So we're looking forward to that one. And with that being said, we will see you guys down the line next week on another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys Podcast.
Sinking low. Everybody needs a light.